you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today, you'll hear from the director who worked with Kirk Douglas on his solo stage show when the actor was 92. And singer-songwriter Joe Henry grapples with his latest record and the difficult circumstances that inspired it.
And I know that people are going to hear this as my so-called cancer record, and I blanch at that. But I also can't fault it because, you know, these songs grew up in that field.
And the Directors Guild is being pressured to amend its parental leave policy. All that today on The Frame. We'll be right back.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
People around the world are reacting to the death of Kirk Douglas. The actor, producer, and author died Wednesday at the age of 103. Jeff Canoe directed Douglas not only in movies but also on stage. Canoe started by recalling when he and Douglas met just before filming started on the 1983 movie Eddie Macon's Run.
Kirk shows up on location in Texas, and we had met for like 5 minutes, you know, when he agreed to do the movie. And he shows up in Texas, and he sends me, just the day before he arrives, a letter with script notes. And I said, I got your notes. You want to go over them? And he said, yes. So we start to go over this list of notes, and I, being an idiot, I'm saying basically no, 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 no as we go down the list to all his suggestions, some of which now looking back were okay, but I was being defensive. And we got about 7 notes in, and he stops me and he goes, let me tell you something. I've made a few movies, you know. And I go, I know. He goes, and I might not be right all the time, but I'm not wrong all the time either. So why don't you get the f*** out of my hotel room? That was our first real meeting.
He wrote in The Ragman's Son, I'm quoting Kirk Douglas now, I'm probably the most disliked actor in Hollywood, and I feel pretty good about it. That he didn't feel bad about being a little crusty or hard to work with. So how would you describe him off camera? He plays tough guys. Was he always tough, or did he show kind of a softer side?
No, he had a fully warm side and a humorous side and a tough side. But anyway, the next morning after this get out of my hotel room, he said to me, now look, he goes, I took this job because I saw your first movie and I respected it. And I'm not giving you notes because just to be a jerk, your job as the director is to make the actors feel like you're listening, at least, even if you're not going to do everything they say. But if you just shut down and say, no, 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 you're not going to get along with the actors, and that's bad for you as a director. And I went, oh. And then he just became my mentor pretty much from that point on.
You also had a chance to direct him in the 1986 film Tough Guys with a frequent collaborator, Burt Lancaster.
Yes.
Can you talk about how Kirk Douglas worked with people over the course of his career, because it wasn't just Burt Lancaster's, directors like Stanley Kubrick. What did he look for in creative partners?
Well, I don't think I can tell you what Kirk looked for, but I know that he told me numerous times, I need to be directed. People are usually afraid to direct me, but I want you to direct me. Kirk and Burt were both actors who, from the studio days, stuck to the script when they were committing to a movie. But Kirk particularly liked to improvise. And the only problems they had were Kirk would get ideas and want to ad-lib, and Burt found that annoying. So they were like a married couple having a bad relationship. And then when we came to Tough Guys and they chose to work together again, they kind of picked up where they left off, where they loved each other and they got on each other's nerves for those same kind of reasons. I remember one in particular. There was a scene in a hotel room with one of the old members of their gang. And this guy is a little crazy. He was played by an actor named Simi Bo. And the guy's in his room alone, and he has a parrot.
Get him up.
Get him up!
Relax, Vito.
Kirk realizes this guy's crazy and they don't want any part of him. His last line in the scene is, "Screw you."
He said, "Turn around. Screw you."
And Kirk turns and throws the line to the parrot, unscripted.
"Screw you too."
And it was a big laugh, and it was a big laugh in the film. And about a week later, Bert called me into his trailer and said, "I want to talk to you." I said, "What's up?" And he said, "You know that scene in the hotel room that we shot last week?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "You let Kirk ad-lib a line." I said, "Well, yeah, but it was funny. It was good." He goes, "If he does it again, I'm walking off the picture."
He seems to be motivated by story. Is that what you really sensed in him, that there were parts certainly that he was drawn to as an actor, but what fueled him? What was the thing that really kind of sparked his interest in a project?
Well, initially, he was kind of always playing characters with flaws. In fact, he liked the flaws because he said, as an actor, the flaws are what make you interesting. In fact, he told me a story about John Wayne, where after Kirk had done Lust for Life, the Van Gogh,
"I'm in a cage of shame and self-doubt and failure. Somebody, believe me."
He had big emotional scenes and broke down on camera. And he said he was friends with John Wayne at the time they were at a party. And Duke, as they called him, took Kirk aside and said, "You know, Kirk, guys like us shouldn't play weak characters." And Kirk said to him, "Duke, you're not really John Wayne, you know." That was one of his favorite stories.
In 2009, you directed him in a stage production, and this is after his stroke in 1996 and his memoir in 2002, My Stroke of Luck.
"You're not going to show clips of my movies."
"Maybe."
"Oh."
"Why not?"
"They don't want to see that."
"No, that's what these people came here to see."
"Movies are not that important."
"What are you talking about? What's more important than a hit picture?"
"They want to know about me, what's inside of me."
"No, they don't. Nobody wants to hear about you. It's me."
What was the impetus of the show, and how did you all come about putting it together?
The impetus was 100% Kirk. You know, he started out wanting to be on the stage. He did the first version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and he liked doing theater, but he didn't get to do it much once he became a movie star. And he wrote it. I worked with him, you know, editing it and creating visual things in the background, film clips and photographs, and we worked the staging of it. But he was the creative force behind that completely, and it was his motivation to do it. A couple of people said, "Kirk, don't do this. You know, it might be embarrassing. You've had your stroke." And he just thought, "No, I'm going to do it."
Jeff Canoe is a director, editor, and producer. Jeff, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you.
Coming up next on The Frame, musician Joe Henry had a cancer scare, and he channeled his diagnosis into his new record.
"You vowed your love from here to eternity."
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Joe Henry is a singer-songwriter who has produced 3 Grammy-winning albums. He's worked with Madonna, Rhiannon Giddens, and the late Alan Toussaint, and he's released 16 solo albums, the latest of which is called The Gospel According to Water. Henry is originally from North Carolina, and his lyrics borrow from the spiritual and often spooky themes of those southern roots. It's particularly noticeable on The Gospel According to Water, which was written after a prostate cancer diagnosis.
It's been decades since I let anybody seduce me into thinking that a so-called single was any part of my life or had anything to do with me. I've always somehow managed to do what I've wanted to do, but I did feel especially liberated in this, you know, in the course of these sessions, to just sort of let fly. I didn't really think I would walk away with a complete album, but when we're recording, you know, there's, you know, even if I'm making an iPhone demo, I'm always pushing myself to see if I can land a performance that is vivid and lives beyond the limitations of that format. So, you know, in this case too, I just felt so liberated. I hadn't recorded in a while. I'd been through a lot. The songs had arrived really quickly, felt really alive for me. And I just wanted to sort of feed myself into the fire of those songs and, you know, go up in sparks and smoke however I might.
How much were these songs influenced by or the result of the fact that a year ago you had a cancer diagnosis for prostate cancer? How did the songs, how do they exist in relationship to that diagnosis?
Well, that's a tricky question, and I knew you were going to ask it. All of these songs grew out of the black earth of that experience. But these songs, you know, none of them are about cancer. I know it's helpful to have that context. It helps people listen in a particular way, but it can also trap people into only hearing songs in one way. And I said, if I'm reluctant to share my personal story, it's not out of a fear for my privacy. It's just that I don't want you to ever think that where a song comes from is what a song is. It's how we recognize it and reach for it, maybe. But it's just then a window, which we look out onto a great vista. And I know that people are going to hear this as my so-called cancer record, and I blanch at that. But I also can't fault it because, you know, these songs grew up in that field, and I can't put them forward very well and then ask people to pretend like they don't know that.
But I think it's also fair to say the album overall is very hopeful and optimistic. It is not at all bleak. It is it's spiritual. It's joyful. It doesn't feel like a sad album.
I don't think so either. I don't think there's anything dark about these songs. I frequently find that I'm inspired to write by, you know, dire moments, not only mine personally, but in the world. But then the songs that arrive invariably are not dire, you know. They might come out of trauma, but they always seem to stand up knowing more and with more optimism than I had going into them.
I want to play a song from the album. This one is called Orson Welles.
Come the turn of story, come the moving floor. If you provide the terms of my surrender, then I'll provide the war.
I want to hear about Orson Welles because there are a couple of real people who are referenced in this album. Another one is General Hsu. I'm wondering how you receive a story or a poem about Orson Welles.
You know, there are certain phrases, words, images that are just, they arrive and I recognize that they're spring-loaded. And I didn't know what Orson Welles had to tell me, but I was wildly interested. And I don't know why he was the delivery system for this song, but he was. And I just started to write. And again, I didn't have an agenda. I was just writing to kind of hear what was being offered. And it happened really, really quickly. I picked up a guitar and sat on the balcony of our bedroom and played it as if I already knew it. It just was one of those kind of spooky moments. Of course, I'm Southern, you know, we believe everything's spooky. It just felt a little bit like a visitation.
We're talking with Joe Henry about his new album called The Gospel According to Water. I want to ask you about water, but I also want to ask you about fishing, because I think you have described songwriting and poetry a little bit like fishing. You put your net in the water, and you don't know what you're going to bring up, but you're going to have something, and then you're going to deal with it.
You're going to make a meal out of it, whatever it is. I mean, more to the point, you know, it's no false humility to say that I don't feel like I invent these songs. I still have to have a keen, you know, knowledge and devotion to craft. You know, I know I have to pick a spot in the river. I've got to have my tools. I've got to have my self-possession and my focus to catch a fish of any significance. But I don't think for a minute that I invented the fish, and I don't need to think so. You know, me pulling a fish in is like me observing that I'm joining a tradition, you know. I'm opening myself to tradition. I'm not trying to claim ownership of it. I'm just trying to be a custodian of that, and I try to be devoted to whatever the song means. It's really not about what I mean. It's about what the song means.
I want to play another song from the album. This one is called Bloom.
This song is old as dirt. It speaks of life lived on the line and far beyond the reach of any thought of yours or mine. Possession is no part of law that stands this side of fear. There's nothing we can hold that means we carry on from here.
I love that idea, the song as old as dirt, that is just out there, that it's independent of you or anybody else. It's just there and you have to grab it or you miss it.
Yeah.
But it's always around you.
Well, I remember being a very young person and being really obsessed with song. And it was a little while before it occurred to me that songs were something that people did, you know, that they weren't just pulled out of the dirt like an onion, you know, fully formed. Because they seemed almost like organic, natural phenomenon to me. And there was some moment about 10 or 11 where I just had the revelation that this is the result of people showing up to work and making decisions and committing to them. And far from then dispelling the mystery of the origin of song, I was completely elated by the idea because I seemed to understand it as if people were, you know, like being visited upon, like I saw some of my southern aunts being, you know, visited upon by a Holy Spirit. This was my Holy Spirit, you know. This is my understanding of a relationship to the divine, you know.
I want to ask you, too, about the music video for this song, which, if you know anything about Andy Warhol's experimental films where he just photographed people looking into a camera, that's pretty much what the music video for Bloom is. It feels like music videos probably are a necessary evil as part of being a musician. How would you describe your relationship to them?
Well, I don't really have a relationship to them. I haven't made one in a really long time. And when this came up, you know, I understand that a lot of the ways in which music is taken to the world thrives on some kind of visual content, you know. And I just flashed on those Andy Warhol screen tests where he would hold a 16-millimeter silent black and white camera on somebody for a very awkward amount of time and watched them, you know, react, try not to react, whatever people did. And I thought, that's the best I can do to make myself completely, candidly available and hope that by my unbroken, pretty much, eye contact, I could just slow down, if not stop time long enough for people to actually hear the song go by. You want to look at something? Stand here with me and we'll hear this song together. I really didn't have a bigger idea than that.
I'm going to ask you this last question about catharsis and healing. There's something that music can give you in terms of how it makes you feel, how it makes you get through something as a listener. Does the opposite work as a songwriter and as a performer, that the putting down of the song becomes part of the healing and the catharsis for the songwriter?
Oh, there's no question about that. When I first got my diagnosis, you know, I kind of retreated for a minute because I didn't understand what was happening to me, and I didn't know how I would respond to therapy. You know, nobody does. As frightened and paralyzed by fear as I was, when I began to write, it was purely, you know, as a means of my own salvation. It connected me to who I was. You know, my identity was not now my diagnosis, you know. It was a specter of my being. It's not an obstacle to my journey. It is my journey, but it doesn't define me. You know, songs are my language, and I wanted them to speak back to me, and they did.
Joe Henry's new record is called The Gospel According to Water. Joe, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All the nights fall swift and soon.
Up next on The Frame, a campaign to get the Directors Guild of America to amend its parental leave policy.
You move like green upon this afternoon. Climbing walls to find me in my...
I feel in the Hispanic communities we're just told to kind of just keep going. Don't feel.
I'm LAist mental health reporter Robert Garova. Getting mental health care is often overwhelming.
If you have a patient that was admitted for a serious suicide attempt, if they haven't been suicidal for 24 hours, the insurance company is like, get them hell out.
My reporting helps unravel the knot by focusing on the stories of people struggling to make the mental health care system work for them.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
Directors, producers, and actors alike have signed on to a letter asking that the Directors Guild of America revise its current parental leave policy. The letter was penned by documentary filmmaker Jessica DeMock. She lost her health insurance after taking time off to give birth to and care for her daughter, which caused her to fall short of the DGA's 12-month minimum earnings requirement. Now DeMock is spearheading the hashtag DGA Parenthood Penalty campaign. She's asking that the Guild extend its earnings window to 18 months for new parents. DeMock told me about her experience working alongside her partner on the Netflix series Flint Town and how that prompted her to ask for new rules.
I joined the DGA in 2017, and I was pregnant at the time. My daughter was born, and I realized pretty quickly that I was going to lose my health insurance. But my partner, who is also my co-director on that project, didn't face quite the same obstacles and didn't lose his health insurance in the same way that I did in that first year. It's worth noting that he also was affected by it. He lost his insurance for a quarter, meaning that at one point both of us were paying out of pocket. But I did realize that, you know, here are two people. We both had a child at the same time. We worked together. We were co-directors on the same project. And I realized the ways that, you know, it impacted me and not him, even though we're very similarly situated. And so, as we all know, women are already underrepresented in the field of directing. And there have been a lot of positive strides towards a more inclusive landscape. But this feels like an obstacle that needs to be cleared in order for women to achieve parity.
And I think I read that you worked up until the day of or the day before you gave birth. Is that right?
I worked up until the day I gave birth. My daughter was 2 weeks late, which I was very excited about because I was not ready to stop working. And so it's not like I was, you know, putting my feet up and asking for, I don't even know why I'm saying that. There would have been nothing wrong with me putting my feet up during the final trimester of my birth. And you don't need to edit around that. I think that like catching myself with that assumption that like, you know, even me saying like, oh, it wasn't like I was relaxing. Like, God forbid a woman relaxes in the last month of her pregnancy. It's really hard.
This is all happening alongside the Academy Awards, where, surprise, not a single woman is nominated for directing, including Greta Gerwig, who made Little Women. What does this issue have to say about the broader issue of how women are and are not welcomed into Hollywood?
This all kind of became a perfect storm because of what you just mentioned. I mean, I was aware when I had my daughter that I was going to lose my insurance, and that seemed ridiculous that there wasn't something set into place. But it was only more recently, a couple of months ago, that I started to kind of rally around this and find other advocates and people to sign this letter, Greta Gerwig being one of them. And I think it's because of the frustration, the snubs, the, like, you know, women still not being able to get to this highest tier and being kept out, that this also feels like an important time to be fighting this fight. Pregnancy isn't something that's uncommon. It's how we all got here. It shouldn't be a surprise when people get pregnant. But yet there's this feeling like, oh, if a woman gets pregnant, well, she must be penalized and she has to take time off. And there's no possible way that we could accommodate something like that. Well, that's crazy. And we shouldn't treat it as such an unexpected thing that comes out of nowhere. We should kind of plan for it. And I think I also became sensitive to it co-directing projects with men. When we released our last project, we would go on press tours. And there were many times that someone would ask my co-directors who are male about the project and their role, you know, what things meant. And then they would kind of turn to me and say, well, what was your role in the project? The assumption being that, like, I'm somehow not what they are. Now, that's an honest mistake, you know. It has nothing to do with my co-directors. My co-directors are great. But the mistake never goes the other direction. No one ever looked at me and said, you must be the director and these must be your producers or whatever they thought it was. And so, you know, I think it's at a time where I'm also just paying attention to it and I'm sensitive to what's happening out there in the world. And I think until you start looking at the ways that women are just like inherently put at a disadvantage, we're never going to really achieve parity.
When you first started thinking about this issue and about voicing your feelings about it, it must have been a little nerve-wracking. And once you start this in motion, you get a lot of people on board. People like Ava DuVernay, Greta Gerwig, Alma Harrell, Brie Larson, Elizabeth Banks, Haifa Al-Mansour. The list is long and growing. What does the support that other filmmakers have given you mean? And do you think there is strength in numbers that might force some change to come about?
Absolutely. I mean, I knew very well that me, Jessica Timock, going into the DGA board and saying this is a problem was not going to be nearly as powerful as me having really strong allies. But I think one of the really surprising and upsetting outcomes of launching this is that we've gotten lots of stories back. I mean, there was a part of me that was a little intimidated to do this because I thought, there's a chance that, like, I'm the only one that just kind of didn't get it together, which is not what I wanted. And so, you know, I did find that a little intimidating. Once we launched, we got so many stories coming in of people saying, this happened to me. This is the same thing that's going on. But also one of the interesting things is that people from other guilds started speaking up. And so I think the strength in numbers that you just asked about is absolutely true. And it goes beyond directing. It really speaks to, obviously, there's a national problem with this, but specifically within the entertainment industry, there's a problem. People talking about it from SAG or from the Writers Guild or from the Producers Guild. And so really realizing that this is something that extends to many parts of this industry.
Jessica Timock is a documentary filmmaker and a member of the Directors Guild of America. Jessica, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Directors Guild has said that it is taking the parenting leave request under consideration. And that'll do it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.